Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We've been making cheese in Wisconsin since before we were even a state, which may be one reason why we win so many awards for it. It's what happens when a whole state dreams in cheese. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
This is Eat Your Heartland Out. I'm your host, Capri Cafaro, and today I'm going to be speaking with an author who covers one of my favorite subjects, and that is amazing things from my home state of Ohio. I am joined today by Renee Castile Cook. She is the author of Ohio Ice Cream and Ohio Buckeye Candy, as well as a number of other books, most of which have to do with food. Some of them don't. But we are going to have a tasty conversation. Renee, thank you for joining the program.
Hey, Capri. Thanks so much for having me.
Now, you have written quite a bit about food in Ohio, but you're not from here, right?
I'm not. I'm actually a Buckeye by choice, not by birth. I'm a Chicago native. Yes, originally.
So what brought you to the Buckeye State?
Sure. Well, originally, I came to attend college at Ohio University, where I met my then boyfriend, now husband, and wasn't a very hard sell to get him as well as almost 20 of our good friends between various Ohio colleges to move back to Chicago post-graduation. So we spent about a decade there afterwards. And then, for some family reasons and some professional reasons alike, decided to relocate back to his hometown of Columbus in 2014.
Mm-hmm. So have you always been a writer, or is this something that, you kind of came by in a more circuitous way?
Definitely the latter. I would say that, writing was an interest of mine and sort of maybe an outlet as a child, but I certainly was not doing that professionally before the relocation. I was actually on the account management side in a related business in advertising. And so I worked on a variety of food and beverage clients. And I think, much of that was serendipitous in the sense that opportunities arose allowing me to work on those brands. But also I just have an interest in that category. And my husband actually sells wine. So the two tend to go well together.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And so, upon relocating to Columbus, the food scene really stood out to both of us because it had changed so much, certainly since he was a child, and having been gone, 10 plus years at that point, almost 15 with the college years in there.
Sure. No, it's definitely one of the, fastest growing cities, if not the fastest growing city in Ohio. And as such, between, population growth and large corporate headquarters, and of course, Ohio State University, it really has become, a cultural mecca as well for the state of Ohio.
Certainly. I found it very interesting in my advertising days that a number of food and beverage clients and competitors would have test markets in Columbus.
Yes.
And so, I knew the city based on that. And certainly there are some major QSR, quick service restaurant, fast food type brands that are headquartered here in Columbus. And so, I knew enough to be dangerous, but the diversity of the cuisine was really what took me by surprise. And as you mentioned, the diversity of the population, which you might not expect from, location in central Ohio, frankly. But in Chicago at the time, at least, and this has changed and loosened up significantly in the last decade, the regulations around mobile food were really tight. And a lot of that was controlled by bar and restaurant owners, indicating that they didn't want mobile food operations within 100 feet of their establishment. As you know, in Chicago, good luck finding 100 feet that doesn't have a bar or a restaurant.
Right.
And then the other hindrance was that we weren't actually allowed to cook on a truck at the time. And so we ended up with about 400 cupcake trucks, but no actual food.
Interesting.
Yes, lots of desserts. And so when coming to Columbus, you know, the city, speaking of 400 trucks, had gone from about 40 to 400 trucks in 4 years. So the period between 2010 and 2014 just saw this surge in the mobile food scene. And having visited Austin, Texas right before our move to Columbus and comparing the two cities, you know, again, being major college towns, kind of similar in terms of diversity of population and whatnot, the food truck scene in Austin has long been sort of a mecca. They have the benefit of year round. And so they can have, you know, pods for their food trucks. People can actually go and find the truck that they're looking for, as opposed to the little bit of a hunter gatherer mentality. but you know, the mobile food scene here really got savvy, and there was an app developed around that same time called Street Food Finder that would allow you to go in and actually say, I want to find this truck. Or if you didn't know the truck's name, you could say, I want this type of cuisine today, or I'm in this area. And I think that really helped. And then that was also around the same time that the Food Truck Festival was created, and it has grown just astronomically in that time period.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I can personally vouch for that as someone who was living in the Columbus area between 2007 and 2016. So I saw a lot of this firsthand, you know, these changes and then the proliferation of the food trucks. And, you know, we're talking food trucks because we, you know, eventually we're going to get to the fact that you did a whole book about food trucks, but you started to write about the food scene for some of the local publications first, right?
Exactly. So kind of taking a sidestep, if you will, from my advertising career, I began supporting Columbus Monthly and their publication, Columbus Crave Magazine, which at the time was a food-focused quarterly. It's since been rolled back into the main magazine. And so there's like a dining section monthly. You get about the same amount of pages. You know, it just depends on how you want to look at that from a publishing perspective. But at the time, there was a separate publication. And so I started writing for the special advertising section. And that made a lot of sense with my background, but it also allowed me to explore the city's food scene and interview chefs and restaurant owners, and at one point even have a little featured recipe, kind of recipe slash product column that was really fun. Yeah.
So how did you jump from that to your first book, which had to do with the food trucks there in Columbus?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, we had been visiting Austin, Texas, and it was my first time there, actually. I've since been a bunch of times because it is such a great town. And my husband and I stopped collecting tchotchkes a long time ago. We've had the great fortune of traveling quite a bit for both personal and professional reasons. And we said, oh gosh, if we keep collecting things on trips, you know, we have nowhere to put them. So we started collecting cookbooks. And for us, it was a way, I just married into my last name. So I write about food, but you know, being a cook now, my husband is actually the chef in our house. And I do a fair bit of baking, but we'll leave all the actual cooking to him. And so we decided to collect cookbooks so that we could recreate our trips at home.
I love
that. Yeah. So, you know, I love it too, because again, I don't do the cooking. He does the recreating and I do the eating and tell him how close he got. So we were in Austin and we're in a kitchen store and we're looking at cookbooks, and I find this series called Trailer Food Diaries. And it's not just a one-off cookbook. There were actually at least three at the time about Austin. And then I noticed a few others, one about Houston, one about Dallas. And then there were two about Portland, Oregon, which is another food truck kind of mecca.
Yep.
And so, you know, the brand marketer light bulb in my head went off, and I said, this isn't just a book, it's a series. And I would love to connect with this author to see if she knows anything about kind of what has happened in Columbus in the last couple of years, and if she has interest in profiling our city. Because in my mind, you know, it stood up just as well to these other markets. I had been to Portland before and been very impressed, obviously, with just the scale of what used to be kind of their main food truck area. And so I did. I cold reached out to her.
Love it.
And you know, the stars aligned, as Tiffany Herlick and I now say, because she is also very into astrology and all the metaphysical realms. And we didn't know for a full 18 months that we actually share a birthday.
So no way.
We're birthday buddies. We're Scorpios. They're on November 7th, just about 2 years apart. Yeah. So, you know, it was really just kind of one of those things that I think you put out into the universe. And if it's meant to be, it comes back to you. And so it did. And she took a chance on me, not having been really, an author before, having had this little bit of writing experience for the magazine. And she pitched it to her publisher, which at the time had said, we would love to continue your series, but we really want our authors to have in-market presence. That's something that the History Press and Arcadia and our imprint, which is American Palette, feel very strongly about. And she said, well, I think this is a way that we can do, essentially, do both. We can have this series continue, but we can have Renee have the in-market presence. And they all took a chance on me. And I had the great fortune of learning from a pro and learning the publishing world from Tiffany.
That's great. So tell me a little bit about this food truck cookbook that you ended up coming out with in 2016.
Yeah. So the series title is actually Trailer Food Diaries. And so we changed that for the Columbus market because trailer food has a bit of a different connotation in the Midwest. And so the tagline, though, is serving up the American dream one plate at a time. And that really spoke to me. Yeah. In the sense of featuring these entrepreneurs and these small businesses that are getting, their start by getting out on the road and the challenges that they face. We have an entire section in the back of the book that is tips if you want to open your own food truck. And
that's
I would
great.
Say at least 50% of them are either be a mechanic or know a really good one. because you think about it, like they're taking their operation out on wheels every single day and everything that could possibly go wrong does, but they are such a tight knit community. And it was fascinating to really become a part of that in sort of a peripheral way, but really they invited me right in,
And so, I was just going to ask, what kind of research did you do to be able to write this book?
Well, taste testing.
Well, I'm sure that was very difficult, but did you, go out and how did you identify? Did you just use that app or did you, research different parts of town? Did you want to have specific types of cuisine that you focused on? How did you really go about tackling something like this and then incorporating recipes into it because it's also a cookbook?
Exactly. So, at that point I was, I had my hooks in a little bit to the food scene. I knew enough folks from interviewing chefs and whatnot. And so I had the connections. I certainly did crowdsource though from our Columbus network and even a little bit on social media to say, give me your favorite food trucks. Let me reach out to them and see, if they're interested in participating, frankly. And to be quite frank, not everybody was. There was one truck in particular who really did want to participate, but the way that their menu was set up, there wasn't a recipe they could necessarily give us, right? And so we unfortunately weren't able to include them. But I would say on the whole, everyone raised their hands and said, oh my God, that's so cool. We'd love to do that. And yes, of course, we can provide recipes. So each truck provided 1 to 3 recipes. We did make sure that we were certainly demonstrating the breadth of the cuisine types here in Columbus, but also we wanted to cover day parts. And so the way all of Tiffany's books were set up, was that there were breakfast items. There were sort of a handhelds type of sandwiches, tacos, that kind of category. And then there are some more ambitious, what I would call dinner type, multi-day project recipes in there too, because we know that, some people, my husband, for example, every once in a while likes to take on a project like that. Some people don't. They want to, go to the truck and have the food there, but they actually started using the book, which I never even thought would happen, but absolutely loved when I started hearing it from multiple people. They used it as like a tour guide to go around town and mark off the ones that they had tried and take notes on which recipes they had sampled from the truck and what other things maybe, weren't in the book that they had that they enjoyed. And then they even started having some of the food truck chefs sign the book if there wasn't a giant line behind them. So I just thought that was so cool in such a fun way. I actually sold the idea and started having all of the places where I've done events sign my copies of whatever book I'm there to talk about that day. I crowdsourced that idea too. So Columbus had this plethora of trucks. We certainly couldn't incorporate quite everybody, but the great fortune was that we did a second book, a follow-up, if you will, and we brought Columbus back into the Trailer Food Diary series under Tiffany's separate publishing company. So she took on the lead publishing role and I took on the lead author role in the Best of Trailer Food Diaries. And that book has all of those markets I mentioned before. So the three Texas markets, Portland, and then Columbus. And we revisited a number of trucks that were favorites, but they all gave us new recipes. And then we were able to even incorporate a few folks that either weren't on the scene at the time or weren't able to participate for whatever reason, but we're now able to. So we've got, you know, a good mix of new trucks, old favorites, but all new recipes in both of those titles.
That's great. We're going to have to keep an eye out for that one as well. So give me some examples of the type of food truck cuisine that you featured from Columbus, just to give listeners a sense of the diversity of what's available there.
Certainly. So one of my favorite trucks still, and they're not on the road anymore, but I absolutely love that we captured them in both books they participated in, both the Columbus Food Truck Cookbook and then the Best of Trailer Food Diaries. And the truck was called Holla, and it was essentially a modernized Jewish delicatessen. Their chicken salad recipe will change your mind about putting just handfuls of herbs into your chicken salad. Every time someone reads it, they question, like, are you sure it's that much dill? And I'm like, it is 100% that much dill. And Chef Katie Rondazzo would come out to events with me, became a really great friend. She's actually birthday twins with my oldest daughter, so that was pretty funny too. But, you know, she would come and sample that chicken salad at events, and she's got a couple of other recipes that she contributed. She went on to open a fine dining concept here in Columbus, and then she has since relocated to California. So we still love her, but of course we don't have her quite here anymore. But one success story that has just grown tremendously since their inclusion in the Columbus Food Truck Cookbook is Ray Ray's. Both of these are featured on the cover, which is why I'm telling you about them. But Jamie Anderson started a barbecue truck, and it was behind a music venue. And so, of course, you know, you got to have the best of both worlds there. It felt very Austin-like, if you will. You've got your music, you've got your barbecue. So they went from a one truck, you know, one or two smoker operation to three brick and mortar restaurants, a standing location at two breweries in town. And for the listeners that may not know, Columbus and really, you know, all of Central Ohio has just also blown up in the number of craft breweries that we have.
Oh, yes.
Absolutely. And so that's been another lovely partnership. You know, what better, if you can't have music and barbecue, then you want beer and barbecue, right? And if you can have all three, why not? So that was another one that he participated in both titles as well. And then, yeah, you know, you've got really quite a smattering of different cuisines. We've got gyros included from two different producers. We've got Pita Bilities and then Buckeye Donuts, actually. So think of a donut shop, but they do. They have a Greek background. They have Greek ownership and have for decades there on campus. And so they provided us with their gyro recipe. And then, you know, you've got even some desserts. So we've got a plantain and coconut upside down cake. Ooh. And that is a fun recipe from a truck that was well-loved at the time called the Explorers Club. They actually moved into a brewery after that as well. And then another truck that's still on the scene is called Aju Mama. And they do it's called duck and cheese, but it's like a version of mac and cheese with a Korean rice noodle. I promise it will change the way you look at mac and cheese.
I want to get on the road and start driving to Columbus right now.
Yes, please. She still is at my local in Clintonville farmers market every once in a while. So I get to say hi to Miss Laura Lee.
I was going to say, I think I went to grade school with her. So.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
What a small world. I love that so much.
I was going to ask you about this off air, but you know what? It came up. Yes, I went to grade school with Laura Lee. So she is a rock star down there. And, that is just too much. I knew.
Well, now you have to make her mac and cheese.
I certainly will. That is fantastic. Well, I mean, you have the food truck world covered, but then you embarked upon a couple other big endeavors, including sweets, ice cream, and the notorious Ohio Buckeye. So which one do you want to take first?
Yeah. So, well, if we go in chronological order, there was a small gap in between where I did a children's book for my kids. It's called Meet Maddie. We don't have to dive into that one, but it's mostly about a monkey and her fashion sense. And so, you know, that was
to me.
That was just a fun kind of interlude, if you will. And then we moved into the dessert category. Not to say that we didn't have some desserts covered in those first two food truck books, but went all in on my sweet side. And, you know, I have been an ice cream lover from the depths of Chicago winters. My mom will tell you, and I'm not sure about the accuracy of her story because I was in preschool, but she claims we went every single day after school and she let me hit the hard stuff right away. There was no vanilla for me. I went straight to the chocolate. Perhaps that's why we went in the dead of winter, because it wouldn't melt all over the place. But, you know, I've been a long time.
You meant business. You meant business.
100%. And so when Arcadia and my publisher, my representative at the publisher came back to me and said, you know, we've got this ice cream book that we're thinking about doing. Actually, what happened was that they had an author on the topic and she had kind of put an outline together. She hadn't started writing yet, but she was Ohio based. I forget exactly which area. And funny enough, she was moving to Chicago. And so they were like, okay, well, you know, if you're going to move, you won't have the in-market presence to promote the book when it comes out. So if you don't want to continue it, we understand. And she said, yeah, you know, but you guys are welcome to still make the book. If you find an author, they're welcome to use my outline as a basis if they want, throw it out if they want, whatever they want to do with it. So incredibly generous. So it was almost like she and I just switched places, right? Being that I'm from Chicago. And so I looked at the outline and it was a great lead into the history of why Ohio is such a prolific ice cream state. And it's really because we were such a prolific dairy state for so long. We had over 2,000 dairy farms at one point. And obviously that just led itself really nicely into, okay, what else are we going to do with all this milk? We're going to make cheese. We're going to make ice cream. And certainly the timing around, you know, the early 1900s and into really like the 1920s, where you had refrigeration or freezing, certainly, but you had novelties kind of coming about. There's a lot of firsts that are from Ohio. And so, you know, the ice cream cone, it owns its attributes to the Mensch's brothers in Ohio. Certainly Harry Burt and the Good Humor operation out of Youngstown, which maybe was the first food truck, right? And so everything came full circle for me because I'm like, okay, this guy's ice cream truck was actually the birth of mobile food. And the fact that he was able to put freezers on it. And really for me as a marketer, you know, create a brand around that became so iconic and synonymous with the ice cream truck visiting your neighborhood every summer. We don't have as much of that anymore, but I will say that it's coming back in a way with the mobile food scene. We've got one truck featured that now has a brick and mortar as well, but it's called Little Ladies Soft Serve. And you know, it's actually an old postal truck, but it's Good Humor-esque. It's like what Good Humor would do if they put two little girls on the side of their truck and made it super cute. And so, you know, I love just profiling these businesses. We didn't get into recipes with this one or with the Buckeye one because that's a little more difficult. But, you know, we really showed why all of these from mom and pop shops on the side of the road that are open, say, seasonally and perhaps even closed this past weekend, to the ones that have become multi-generational family businesses that are household names like Grater's or Handles from the Youngstown area, and certainly Jenny's, which is now, you know, nationwide, but started right here in Columbus.
Well, and Handles actually has a franchise footprint all across the country now, too.
They do. They just opened one in Culver City, California.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. There's a reason when you think of Wisconsin, you think cheese. Cheese is a huge part of Wisconsin's history and future. In Wisconsin, the state of cheese, the tradition of cheesemaking excellence began 180 years ago, before Wisconsin was recognized as a state. Immigrants traveled to settle in this lush, green hills of Wisconsin, bringing their cheesemaking traditions with them. These storied skills, combined with the freshest milk available, created a cheesemaking culture that is uniquely Wisconsin. Wisconsin's 1,200 cheesemakers, many of whom are third and fourth generation, continue to pass on old-world traditions while adopting modern innovations in cheesemaking craftsmanship. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
So, you know, growing up in the Youngstown Warren area, you know, I certainly grew up with Good Humor. They're painted on the side of the Mahoning Valley Historical Society building. We actually did an episode for this program on that. And then, of course, Handles, which is a point of pride here and was nominated by USA Today for years as one of the best ice creams in the country that was getting shipped to, you know, to celebrities and this sort of thing, but it was founded in 1945 and here in the Youngstown Warren area, Northeastern Ohio. So, you know, I think we do take a lot of pride in our food here. And I thought it was really interesting that, you know, you took on that ice cream story of Ohio, because people don't necessarily associate dairy with this state. But if you live here, you know that there's a lot of big names when it comes to ice cream.
Certainly. Yeah. And, you know, I think we're slowly shedding our Cowtown moniker here in Columbus. But even I, 10 years ago moving here, had to laugh that Ohio State University still keeps a farm of stocked with cows on Lane Avenue, which, if you know that area, it's like the heart of Upper Arlington. I mean, that would be prime real estate. And there are cows. I take my children to see them. It's hilarious. So, you know, I think we hang on a little bit to some of that heritage in a really positive way. And there are so many wonderful stories of businesses like the Dairy Hut in Pataskala that was owned by the same family for four decades. And they were getting ready to retire. And, you know, really, they didn't want to let go of the business, but they needed to. And there's this young couple. They have three little kids. They run a farm themselves as their day job. And they said, we can't let this go. And so 2 years ago, they passed the reins over. And the new family has had it operational for the past two summers. They've done some modernization. They've even made the space a little bit bigger. I kid you not, this was like a 12 by 12 building that they put about six, you know, high school or college kids working their summer job in there. And it was a dance. They had it choreographed. And so they made it just slightly bigger, but not big enough, maybe 15 by 15 now, not big enough to change the footprint, just to give them a little bit of elbow room. And they modernized the building just slightly, but it retained its character and certainly retained its Coney sauce, which people line up for on closing day so they can stock their freezer with pints to get them through winter. You know, it's just, these stories are the best. You've got Masons up in Ohio City, the area of Cleveland. And what I love about their business model is they realized, okay, if we're going to go all in on ice cream, you know, there is some cyclical nature to it. Certainly when you live in Cleveland, Ohio.
I was going to say, when you're a lakefront, it's not that easy.
No, exactly. You know, when that snow starts falling, it doesn't stop. And so they pivot their entire business somewhere around the end of October, November timeframe to ramen noodles. And they make just absolutely fantastic ramen all winter long. And now people have, you know, asked so many times that they keep a stock of pints for them to buy. So there is some ice cream in the winter, but it used to be 100% ramen for like 4 or 5 months and then ice cream the rest of the time. And now in the summertime, it's all ice cream all the time, except they're also doing a fantastic Korean hot dog that you can get as half a hot dog and half is like a mozzarella cheese stick. I just had it in August. Yeah. And I was just blown away. You know, so you've got these, we have a lot of sidebars in the ice cream book because there are these fantastic stories. Ohio is also the birthplace down in Wilmington near Cincinnati of the banana split. There is another market. I think it's in, I'm going to blank on if it's in Kansas, that that claims they own the banana split, but
there's always some kind of a dispute.
Right, the controversies, you know, the controversies around ice cream and even around the origin of the Buckeye candy. It's actually a great segue.
Before we get into Buckeye candy, though, I got to ask you, did you go to all these different places for the research to do your book?
So I certainly tried to cover as much ground as I could. And I have the good fortune of, you know, having some extra little taste testers with me. And so they just turned four last week. My almost four-year-old twins were almost three-year-olds last summer when we were promoting this, and they are happy to taste test everything.
I wonder why.
Yeah, right? They're like, Mom has the best job right now. We actually got a delivery. So if I couldn't get to a place, oftentimes they would ship me ice cream, which was just lovely.
That's amazing.
But Isley's, if you're familiar with Isley's, at one point had tons of locations.
And their chip chop ham, which is a whole other story for a different day, but
100%. Yeah, that's another good topic. So Isley's actually sent me a shipment and they slightly overdid themselves, but of course we were appreciative. It was like 4 gallons of ice cream and it came on trick or treat night. So here in Columbus, we almost never trick or treat on Halloween. It's called Beggar's Night. It's an odd little tradition. I think it has something to do with avoiding both high school as well as, of course, Ohio State football. So if, you know, it falls on one of those days, we move our trick or treat. Needless to say, my kids had already gone out and gotten their ice cream. And then I bring this box in and, you know, in perfect timing, it is on dry ice because that's how you ship ice cream. So we open this box and it's like the witch's cauldron has opened on Halloween night and they were completely mesmerized. The candy went by the wayside and they wanted to open every single gallon and try all the flavors. And Isley still does some really iconic to them flavors that, you know, you really can't find anywhere else. There's one called Maricopa and it's almost like this, I don't want to call it butterscotch, but it has those notes in it. You really just have to kind of taste it. And you can find them at groceries still. So they're, you know, at Kroger and Giant Eagle and things like that, which is really,
I think they do White House ice cream, which is basically just the cherry, the vanilla cherry, which is one of my grandfather's favorites. Yeah. Isley's is a real, you know, nostalgic brand for a lot of people in Ohio and in Western Pennsylvania. This is such a fun book, but now we got to talk Buckeyes because, you know, first for those listeners who are not from the Buckeye State, explain what a Buckeye is, literally as well as the candy.
Sure. Well,
slash, is it a candy?
Right. Is it a candy? Is it a cookie? Is it a confection? You know, the world may never know. It depends on who you ask around here. But the Buckeye itself is a useless, potentially poisonous nut that falls off a tree by the same name. There are actually multiple species of Buckeye tree. California has a Buckeye tree. I think there's like 2 or 3 more, but the Ohio Buckeye tree, and I do not know its genius name. I'm sure it's written down somewhere in the book, but I would not be able to pronounce it anyways. I actually have one in my backyard looking out at it right now. This is the time of year, of course, perfectly coincided to football season, they fall like crazy. And we have already begun our collection. So you get, you know, the teeny tiny babies to the giant buckeyes. But essentially what it is imagine a walnut that its shell cracks on its own when it falls off of the tree. And so, you know, most of the time it's already out, but sometimes you have to peel that shell off a little bit. And when you open it up, it's got a dark brown exterior, except a circle sort of in the middle top that is like a light tan color. And so there was a woman, Gail Tabor Lucas. She is actually not from Ohio either, so we share that, but she was here because her husband was attending graduate school at Ohio State University, and she's from Oklahoma, and her mother sent her a Christmas package with a peanut butter ball. Now, this was fully enrobed in chocolate, and so this is more like a truffle candy, if you will. And of course, you know, they were delicious and they were something that Gail had grown up with. And she asked her mom for the recipe to recreate them for some more friends and family and some events they were going to. And as she is dipping the peanut butter ball in the melted chocolate, so that's what you do. You take a peanut butter center, which is mostly peanut butter and a lot of powdered sugar, maybe a little bit of
powdered sugar.
Yeah. And then you roll that and then you dip it in melted chocolate. There's a debate as to whether or not folks add some confectioner's wax to that to make it shiny and make it set. My mother-in-law does. Some others don't. And so you take a toothpick, you dip that in. Well, she dipped it in only 3/4 of the way, and she pulled it up, and she said, "Doesn't this look like a Buckeye?" And he said, "Yeah, it actually really does." And so that's the legend of how the Buckeye candy was born. She started taking them to tailgate parties.
Tailgate parties, I remember.
You know,
that story,
which they're, you know, of course, they are a staple of at this point. And all the way through the holidays, so we see Buckeyes start falling from the tree. We know we need to start making them, and we take them to every party we can through the football season, and then straight on through the holidays. I did see the website The Kitchen, spelled without an E. I saw an article last year where they said that the Buckeye was Ohio's favorite Christmas cookie. So again, a little bit of a debate as to whether or not, you know, this is a candy or a cookie. I would probably put it a little bit more firmly into the candy, you know, area, but, or we can call it a confection. You can ask like the Buckeye lady when you talk to her, maybe Alicia will have a firmer stance, but I will say that Fran DeWine, who I had the great opportunity to meet at Ohio Anna, she was looking for
who is the First Lady of Ohio.
Yes,
currently, and is someone who does a lot in regards to libraries. So to put Fran DeWine in context for people not from Ohio.
Yes, perfect. Apologies for that. So she and I met at the Ohio Anna Book Festival, and she was telling me that she was looking for something to bring during the COVID-19 pandemic to a lot of the sites that they visited for the first responders. And she wanted to bring Buckeyes, but she knew that they don't always travel that well. And especially if it was hot out or something like that, they can get a little melty. So she actually took the peanut butter center and baked it into a batch of brownies and took that. And, you know, in my mind, a brownie is also not quite a cookie, but I will take that one as our, you know, favorite state treat if we have to pick one.
Absolutely. That sounds totally delicious. So what is covered in the Buckeye book? I'm assuming you give that kind of contextual folklore history of how the Buckeye, you know, was established, and you talk to individuals like the Buckeye Lady, who we'll have at some point on the program. But tell me what you did to put this book together.
Yeah, so the format is very similar to Ohio Ice Cream. So that is, that we interviewed a little over 20 Buckeye producers from across the state. We wanted to make sure that we had those household names that have been producing Buckeyes since shortly thereafter Miss Gail Lucas Tabor. Now, that was 1960, 1964. Yep. The controversy around her recipe, actually, is that she kept it very close to the chest, didn't share it with anyone, but she and her husband were relocating when he graduated, and a friend convinced her to share it, and she said, okay, I will, as long as you don't share it with anybody else. Well, I'm not so sure how friendly this friend was, because not only did she share it, she put it in the Ohio State Alumni Magazine under her own name.
Yep.
Gail didn't find out until about 20 years later. She comes back to Ohio State in the early 1980s, and someone tells her that, yeah, it was run in the Alumni Magazine under this person's name. So at this time, she is a reporter for the Arizona Republic, and she Ooh. Runs her own article reclaiming the origin of the Buckeye Ball, which is, you know, what she renamed it from, the peanut butter ball, and publishing her recipe. We actually have her recipe published in the book. I've gotten some feedback that it can be a little bit heavy on the powdered sugar, and so you might want to play with your ratios a bit, but certainly you can find recipes for the Buckeye, you know, candy in other places. This one isn't meant to be a recipe book or a cookbook. Mm-hmm. Neither was Ice Cream. This one was really meant to feature those stories and talk a little bit about the nuance, because, you know, when I first embarked on this, my publisher and I were saying, is a Buckeye just a Buckeye, just a Buckeye? Well, it's really not. And you would be shocked in some ways to find out that some people, you know, they change the chocolate coating. So there's a company called Bellbrook Chocolates. They're actually in Centerville now, but they kept their name when they moved over from Bellbrook. And the owner and her husband, she was a milk chocolate fan. He was a dark chocolate fan. And so she created this bespoke blend of chocolate that they use for all of their confections, including their Buckeye. So whereas at some producers, you can pick between a milk chocolate Buckeye or a dark chocolate Buckeye, at Bellbrook, you are getting their Bellbrook chocolate. And that's really what they're known for. They actually also, another sort of quote unquote controversy is whether or not you fill the toothpick hole. Some people like to cover that up. You know, once you take the toothpick out, you kind of just either use the toothpick itself or finger if you're willing, depending on who you're serving it to or if you have gloves on, but to close that hole up. My mother-in-law sides on that area of presentation, but at Bellbrook, they want you to know that they're homemade, and especially because they are coming from a business. So they actually leave the toothpick hole, and they're featured on the cover of this book, and you can kind of see, you know, that approach. But you've got some more, again, modern makers, right? And so we saw that theme in the ice cream book on sort of new takes on an old staple, and newer takes on the Buckeye are actually, as we mentioned, from the Buckeye Lady. And she does something called the Stuffed Buckeye. She was the original. There are a couple of others in the book that feature a similar product they call maybe a Bursting Buckeye. But the concept essentially is that they take, so for the Buckeye Lady, her first was M&Ms, and you'll find a couple of M&Ms inside and then an M&M on top so that you know what you're getting into. But she does everything. She has over 80 varieties at this point. The one on the cover is her red velvet, because it obviously goes very well with the scarlet and gray motif that we selected.
Oh, yes, of course.
But, you know, even at the holidays, one of my favorites of hers is peppermint bark. And she's got, you know, the peppermint in there. She did Christmas in July recently, so that one's top of mind because I got to have it in the summer, which was a fun treat. She also did a dreamsicle, like an orange creamsicle this summer. And her fall flavors are just out, and she's doing a pumpkin, of course, and an apple cider, I believe, and a variety of other really fun things, maybe a maple. So, you know, on face value, you're thinking, does it still taste like a Buckeye? And it really does. They're very complimentary. I will say, she has done a savory one before, the everything spice, everything bagel spice. Who hasn't, you know, done a riff on that at this point? Even Jenny has made a very polarizing version of that ice cream. But I did have the chance to taste that, and it works. You know, there's something kind of different and fun about it. You get the little crunch of the seeds, but the sweet and the savory play really nicely together.
That is definitely not what I would expect from a Buckeye. But as you said, I mean, it's really interesting to see how people are taking, you know, new approaches to something that has become a classic over the decades. So what's next on the horizon for you? Do you have any more food books up your sleeve?
You know, I always am solicited, of course, with what people want to see next. And so I've gotten donuts recently. I've gotten macaroons, actually. I'm not sure we have like a thin red line that really ties either of those directly to Ohio. Now, we certainly have plenty of donut producers, you know, both the old and the new. And I would love to explore that just as a personal, I would like to eat all the donuts. Macaroons is funny to me because the last time I was visiting home in Chicago, it seemed like there was a new macaroon vendor on every single corner. They're actually my older daughter's favorite cookie. And so, you know, that could be a fun one as well. I'm really not sure yet. We're going to kind of see where things take us. Maybe we'll swing back savory. Maybe we'll loop back to that children's book and see if we can't make Maddie into a series and give her some little sisters now that my oldest has a couple of little sisters. So, you know, right now just focused on promoting this title since it just released in August, really through the fall football and the holiday season.
What a perfect time to, you know, celebrate the Buckeye in Ohio and beyond. Where can folks find your books?
So all the usual suspects, our friends at Amazon, Target, and Barnes & Noble are gracious to carry the title. But, you know, I do recommend people check out their independent bookstores as well. If they don't have the book, as long as you give them the title and the name of the author, they'll be able to request it. And then a lot of the shops featured in the book are actually carrying the title as well. I love that option because you can get your book and your Buckeyes right there together. It's a great gift idea to pair the two. Obviously, if you're giving Buckeyes anyways, why not add the book in this year for something a little bit different? And then you can find me on my website as well, which is just reneecastillocook.com.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for sharing all of this tasty material with us. We're really excited to learn about your books. And of course, always excited, at least from my selfish perspective, to celebrate everything that Ohio has to offer. Renee Castile Cook, thank you so much for joining Eat Your Heartland Out.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Eat Your Heartland Out. This episode was produced by me, Capri Cafaro. Our audio engineers are Liam Werner and Armin Spengen. Theme music by Jason Shaw. Eat Your Heartland Out is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.